bands, but the FM bands, and could actually cover the amateur band too, the 2 meter band. I'll let it drop. Now, what RCA, the live studies, they live with mobile exotic setups where they could check the field strength of their transmitters. And one of the biggest problems was ghosts due to multiple path reflections. So the antennas had to be somewhat directive, and the people who installed them had to position them properly to get the best results with the least amount of ghosts. The people that lived in northern Manhattan were getting reflections from the George Washington Bridge, so this was a real big problem. Now, what happens is, eventually, they start using the straight dipoles again to match the 50-ohm impedance for the higher-priced sets. And then a breakthrough comes through. The biggest breakthrough was the fact that they found that they could put an angle on the antenna. It wasn't a straight across dipole. It was now a dipole where you're bending dipole arms at an angle. And what happens is very interesting. I'll let it drop. The angle bent antenna became known as the conical antenna, and it became, the antenna was an X, looked like an X from the front view, and from the top view it looked like a broad B, to give you an idea of what it was. And it turned out that this was very broad in frequency, and would match either 300 or 50 ohm impedance. And it's very interesting how they showed this in an RCA article. It showed that you could look at it in this way, that so many inches of the antenna were went away from the center insulator was actually a matching part to match the impedance of the meter of the antenna. That may sound very funny to you, but if you go into a micro Polish home, you get the same thing. Of course, the polarization is different and all that, but you still get the same thing. And what you're seeing with the conical antenna is a very broadband antenna, which will match either 50 ohms or 300 ohms. It doesn't make any difference, because the antenna takes care of it. It's so broad in impedance range. And I noticed, Dick, that you did say that an antenna can match any impedance, but according to the RCA discussions, a straight dipole is best if you don't try to use it above 70 ohms. It goes from around 30 to 70 some odd ohms where it works the best. But once you bend the arms of the dipole, it becomes broader. So what do you think of that discussion so far, Dick? W2ILP, go.
Waiting a nice long time for things to reset. Well, you lived through an extremely interesting piece of history there, Bob. For those who want to know about the early days of television, one of the most popular, very first 10-inch television sets was the RCA Model 630. And if you ever get your hands on a Model 630, go see one in a museum, you'll see that it's got the main rotary dial for the channel selection, and you would expect that channel selection to be through channel 2 through channel 13. It wasn't. It was channel 1 through channel 13. In the very early days of frequency allocation by the FCC for television, there was a channel 1, which I think spanned 48 to 54 megacycles. I remember in 1948 using a RCA 630 television set in Kings Park at my grandmother's farm in Kings Park on Old Comac Road. And Indian Head Road is where it was located. And when I would tune to what was Channel 1, I wouldn't see television, but I heard ham radio operators. I heard the then 6-meter ham radio operators. And that probably was my first introduction to ham radio. Let me drop. Way back in the dark ages of 1948, I'm using an FM discriminator designed for television audio reception. And off to one side are these amplitude-modulated ham radio operators, and I'm hearing them, the 6-meter operators of the day. The double conical antenna is something that I often installed when I was doing television repair and installation work in the late 50s. Mel and I worked our way through college by doing television repair. I was running a business of repairing and installing the television set in Middle Island, Long Island. On quite a number of occasions, I installed one of those double conical antennas. When it comes to that traveling V dipole-like antenna, I can't remember the brand name now, but there was a particular popular brand in the middle 50s where... did somebody just tell me that the television set the brand name? The antenna brand name?
It was Channel Master.
Beautiful. That's it. Channel Master, I think it was called the Traveling V. And I vaguely remember there was about 7 or 8 of those Vs, if I got it correctly. And that was a Yagi-like antenna. It was, you could call it a mixture of a log periodic antenna, but it had directivity. It had broad bandwidth. It had directivity. And a beautiful antenna. You aimed at, from where I was living at the time, in Middle Island, Long Island, which is pretty deep into Suffolk County, you aimed that toward New York City, and we got darn good reception on that thing. Way out there on channels 2 through 13. Not very much snow. Worked like a charm. The very first television set my family had in their own home, let me drop, was later 1948-49, a Philco set, but the temporary antenna they set up on the second floor of the house, which is where my bedroom was a folded dipole made out of 300-ohm twin-lead antenna, draped down through the hall, down the stairs, into the television set in the living room, and eventually they installed a double conical antenna on the roof of the house and gave us quite a significant improvement in reception. That's when I was living in Farmingdale. So these are the early antennas that Bob is telling us about in the early days of television. As they developed better and better antennas with more and more gain, more and more directivity, better and better front-to-back ratio to get rid of the ghosts, particularly in places like New York City, I worked with a number of engineers who were installing antennas in New York City. Getting a strong enough signal for good television reception in New York City was easy. The hard part, the guys who were installing television sets for New York City apartments in the mid-50s, late 40s, mid-50s, and so on, the hard part was to position the antenna in angle, altitude, location, and whatever, so that the multi-bounce signal from all of those other buildings, the ghosting effect. In other words, let me drop for a minute. The signal coming from the Empire State Building directly into your antenna worked like a charm. But then there's a second, third, fourth, fifth, sixth signal that bounces off a building, bounces off the street, bounces off something else. That second, third, fourth signal are weaker in magnitude, that's the good news, but they traveled a longer path. They're delayed in time. And the delayed signal gave you a ghost shifted to the right. Each horizontal line of your television signal of the old days, the NTSC standard, was roughly 63 microseconds long. That longer path, if it was another fraction of a microsecond, gave you a ghost image displaced to the right, and it's a little bit fun to watch it at first, but when you wanted to see a nice high-resolution picture of some pretty person on the television set, and you're seeing these ghosting edges to the right of everything that you're looking at, it was a bit unpleasant. So the hard part of the installation people doing television installation in those days was to find the right location for the antenna, the right kind of an antenna, so that those other multi-path paths would be canceled out, so to speak. You'd have to carefully position the antenna so that you can get an acceptable level of ghost so that the person buying the television set would be happy with the reception. The Mallory Induct Tuner was specifically being used, on a number of military programs at that time that the guys working around me at Airborne Instruments Laboratory in 1964, they were using that thing. I can't remember the name of the project right now, but that Mallory Induct Tuner, beautifully well-designed thing, which I think spanned something like 50 to 300 megacycles. This tuning assembly of about three rotary induct tuners, as I seem to remember, with some capacitors in there. You turn the knob on the front end of this thing. It was a preamplifier, a local oscillator tuning assembly. I think it used a 6J6 tube, and that Mallory induct tuner, a beautifully well-designed assembly that would tune from something like 50 to 300 megacycles and give you a nice reception as far as the RF tuning is concerned, as far as the impedance matching is concerned, as far as the sensitivity is concerned. That was an extremely well-designed thing that ended up in a number of military programs, and I think some of the more progressive television sets of that day was using that Mallory induct tuner that Bob is bringing to our attention. You've lived through some interesting pieces of history when you were doing that work at Emerson in New Jersey. And I think you mentioned the fact of the word Yagi antenna, and maybe you're talking about that the traveling V antenna. Bob, back to you for any further fills on this. W2ILP. You could write some quite interesting stories, Bob. K2RIW in the TechNet. Wait for the beep and watch you watch.
I want a comment, Dick.
Go ahead with that comment, Mel.
You mentioned the Mallory tuner, Mallory inductor tuner. Dumont bought up almost all of them. They had some kind of deal going with Mallory. That's why most Baldwin only saw it on Dumont's set. In fact, the tuner was the only one designed to use 72 ohm cables. Dumont, remember, all their television sets were designed around a 72 ohm impedance because of that Mallory tuner, where everybody else was using the twin lead, Dick, over.
In the early days, the lowest loss transmission line of reasonable cost was the so-called 300 ohm twin lead. You almost never see the stuff around anymore. I've got a couple of rolls of it, very small rolls. It's sort of an antique. But in its day, in fact, some of my earliest VHF antennas, my 432 megacycle antenna in 1970 installed on this particular tower, was fed with 300 ohm transmitting type twin lead antenna. We all slowly switched over to coax. A lot easier to use, a lot more weatherproof. You didn't have to worry about going against metal surfaces and going through holes in the wall and so on. We eventually became more and more enamored with coax cable and the better and better designs of coax cable with lower and lower loss at reasonable cost as time went along. That's the good news. But once you go to a coaxial cable, which is an unbalanced kind of transmission line, now if you're a purist and you want the highest possible performance, you do require some form of balaning structure. Balaning means the transition between an unbalanced transmission line, meaning the coax, and the antenna, which most of the time, a well-designed antenna, is a balanced load. And what a balancing structure does, and we've had a couple of lectures on that, Mel and I, on the TechNet. I'll admit that not everyone knows that one yet. It's a little bit of a black box mystery as to what a balance really does. But you use one of those properly on a well-designed antenna, and it does do some very nice things. Back to you, Bob. W2ILP. As I said, you live through some very interesting history. K2RIW on the TechNet. Watch you watch.
Well, when you get into the history, there's a lot of stuff that I lived through and I was very alert to. And I got all the magazines of the day. If I didn't get them, I didn't buy them. I got them in the public library. And I was very interested in television. In fact, I got involved in, as a kid, trying to figure out how I could use the RCA scanning spinning loop deck, a color television set, which I did, and then I wrote several letters to CBS up in Connecticut, and I had the listings of suggestions I had made for their type of color television. But there's a few things that you said that I don't agree with in terms of being a nitpicker on history. So I'll let it drop. Prior to World War II, the Hams had a 5-meter band. They did not have 6 meters. And it was at that time when there was a channel on TV. Channel was given to the Hams for 6 minutes only after Channel 1 stopped existing as a television channel. This is all by FCC regulation. The RCA 630 TS chassis was originally designed for a 10-inch picture tube. It didn't come out of production until after World War II. And so it never had to turn to channel. Every time I serviced them, I built a clone, which is a Technaster clone of the RCA 630TS. I built it when I was a senior in school. And after I built it, I gave it until I brought it to a hand who had a key there and had the test equipment and helped me get it aligned so it could work. I'll let it drop. I still have an RCA 630S chassis in the basement that was made to work with a 20-inch rectangular picture tube by modifying the high voltage and the deflection yokes and so forth to work with that CRT. And it's a monster, and right now it's inoperative because there's been a flood in the cellar that destroyed what there was of it. And I keep saying I'm going to get it thrown out to the dumps, but I want to take the power transformer off it first. So, the 630 was around for a long time, the 32 Wonder. And Dumont was not the only one to use the Mallory-Ware tuner. Fred Andrea Company, also known as Fender, did the same exact thing. And there were other companies on the West Coast that were making TV sets. I think Hoffman at one time used the Mallory-Ware tuner as well. So Dumont wasn't unique. But they probably made most of them. And when Dumont went out of business, Emerson took over the Dumont name and made their same television sets and put the Dumont name on them. So that's a history, and it really talk about antennas. But what I wonder is why Hams never tried to use conical antennas on 2 meters. Back to you, Dick, from W2FA.
That's a darn good question, Bob. Why did Hams never use double conical antenna on 2 meters? And they never used a bow tie-like antenna. When it comes to UHF television reception, there is a little bit of a connection between a double conical antenna, a conical antenna, and a bow tie antenna. And for UHF television, the bow tie antenna was extremely popular for a while. It's a rather broad band of kind of antenna. And when you study the Chapter 4 of Antenna Engineering Handbook, anything from the 2nd through the 4th edition, and it's Chapter 3 in the 1st edition of the JASIC Antenna Engineering Handbook, you will see not only the Brown and Woodward curves for dipole-like antennas, monopole antennas, where it plots all the resistive and reactive components, but the very next page begins a series of impedance measurements done again by the Brown and Woodward crew or another crew just like you make these cone-shaped or skeleton cone-shaped devices for the quarter-wave monopole radiator, and you get much more bandwidth for both the resistive and the reactive component. That whole concept of a basically broadband antenna structure, for a bunch of reasons, never caught on with the ham radio operators. Let me drop. And I think the main reason for that, Bob, is that we ham radio operators think that each one of our ham bands is extremely narrow band. The 144 to 148 megacycle region is a little bit more than 3% bandwidth, whereas these television antennas have to cover, you know, 2-to-1 active frequency regions. So the broadbanding techniques become popular with television, and the ham radio operators think they don't need frequency broadbanding because they consider their ham radio bands kind of narrow band. You don't pick up extra gain when you use these broadbanding techniques. So I think that's another reason the ham radio operators didn't pursue them. Of the 5,000 kinds of antennas that exist on planet Earth, I'm sorry to say that the total number of those that are seriously experimented with by ham radio operators and articles written on them is a fairly small fraction of that. And there's some reasons for that, and some of it is just sort of popularity. Quite often when a guy gets on a ham band, the first thing he does is talk to his buddies and open up the books and say, what kind of antenna is popular? Should I buy or should I build? And they take the more traditional approach. It's only a couple of guys like Bob who decide to strike out and think out of the box and use some other kind of antenna that has been popular up to that time. Let me drop. When it comes to color, most of the people in the sound of my voice think that all television sets should be color. When Bob and I and Mel cut our teeth in electronics, there was nothing but black and white television. The idea of transmitting a signal through the air and getting a beautiful picture and watching that picture move and hear news reports and watch Howdy Doody and all these other, and the Captain Video and his video ranges and Tom Corbett Space Cadets, these are some of the popular programs way back in the late 40s that these three guys can tell you about. We thought that black and white was beautiful, and the idea of color sounded great, but we didn't think we really needed it. Oh boy, were we wrong. And the very early color sets, because the degree of difficulty of making the three separate phosphors, red, green, and blue, to give you a color picture, was in those days extremely difficult. Let me drop. So in the very beginning, the experiments for making color were to create a wheel device where one third of the wheel was red colored vellum, another third of it was green, another third of it was blue, and you spun that wheel at a rather high speed, and they would alternate the frames of the picture. In other words, one whole frame of the picture would be red, one whole frame of the picture would be in green, and one whole frame would be blue. The picture was flashing. The black and white cathode ray tube was transmitting a picture, but it was transmitting the picture in three separate sequential chunks, and when you had the wheel properly synchronized, you got what arguably is the world's most beautiful color in its day. Those rattan filters that were on that color wheel gave you the purest possible red, green, and blue. Therefore, you have extremely good color by that technique. That's the good news. But you had this great big spinning wheel that had to be properly synchronized, and for the first half hour or hour or two that you watched that picture, to an ordinary human eye, it looked like it had a lot of flicker to it, because you were not getting the picture all at once, if you know what I mean. The human brain will sort of adapt to that, and all of a sudden you don't see the flicker anymore. But arguably that was the purest color mankind ever produced in that time frame. And when they finally created the red, green, and blue dotted type cathode ray tube with the mask inside, it did give you color, but red was always low in performance of brightness output and purity of color and so on. It took a lot of research into exotic chemistry for the phosphors to give you what you and I see today as a color picture tube, and we take it for granted. The amount of technology that went into that, particularly when it comes to the Sony Triniton type tube and whatever, there's an awful lot that took place to give you what you and I all take for granted today. Let me pass it over to Mel, because I'll bet you, if I know you, Mel, you were a guy that owned a color wheel, color television set, or at least you would find somebody who had one and visit him periodically. Give us some words on that one, Mel. K2KEY, how did you first see color? K2LIW in the TechNet.
Yes, this is K2KEY. Oh, yes, I've had a color wheel. Actually, it had two reds, two greens, and two blues on the wheel, 36 inches in diameter, had a 10-inch opening, rectangular opening on it. It was made up very well. CBS, what's called a CBS color wheel, and had a little, like a sort of a base, like a right angle platform that stuck out that flipped underneath the television set so that it aligned the cutout space where you were looking perfectly with the screen, very solid mounting. And yeah, I had a lot of fun with that thing, that color wheel. Too bad I got rid of it. I did sell it for a guy that was collecting. I have my own collection. I do still have one of the first RCA color sets that went into production called the CTC-5. I have one of them in my museum. I also have RCA's first black and white set. It was not a 630 chassis, believe it or not. It was a KRK. They called it the KRK chassis. Later on, they adopted the KRK number as their tuner. That became their tuner number, the KRK, but originally it was their chassis number, the KRK. So I have one of those then.
And a vertical tube, Mel?
46. And I have went through all that, Dick. Anything you want to know about, I fooled with that stuff. I spent my whole life with this jazz, as you would say, and I can tell you anything you want to know about all of them, because I did actually went through it all, and it was interesting, let me tell you. As far as the first concept, the RCA, the CTC-5, it was a misery. Couldn't keep that thing in adjustment. You spent more time adjusting that thing than you did watching it over.
Yeah, what Mel is mentioning is now called color alignment or color convergence. And in order to make those three beams, the red, green, and blue beam, accurately come out of the gun assembly of the cathode ray tube, land on just the right spot on the front face to be properly aligned, to properly track all the way across the screen, the color chrominance alignment, the color purity alignment, the focus. You had to have all three beams properly focused, properly aligned, track each other across the whole darn screen. And once you finally got the television set properly aligned, if somebody decided to change the furniture in your living room, and the television set used to be against the north wall, and now you put it against the south wall, the difference in the Earth's magnetic field would change that color convergence alignment. And if you didn't have a color convergence signal generator in order to do that realignment, you looked at a picture that was, in some cases, nowhere near as desirable. And the amount of integrity, the amount of fidelity required by all of that circuitry that does all of that alignment of that cathode ray tube, in order for it to maintain its performance for those three separate beams and one not drift with reference to the other in horizontal width, vertical height, focus, or whatever, intensity, for all of that to stay pure for more than a month on a television set of those days was a very difficult thing. We take that all for granted. The early days of color television were beautiful to look at when it was working right, but my goodness, was it difficult to maintain, and you paid big bucks for those sets, and you ended up, you ended up paying pretty big bucks to the guy who came in periodically to reconverge and realign your color television set if you were a very discriminating television watcher. We went through a lot. And again, you guys take it all for granted. Bob, I'm going to move on to the next guy. You've lived through some very interesting history. Guarantee you're going to be telling us more about those antenna developments in the future weeks. John was the next person who signed in. W82 Victor Juliet Hotel. John, what would you like to talk about tonight? K2LAW in the TechNet. My name is Dick. Be sure you wait for the beep and watch your watch so we don't time out the machine every minute and a half or so. You got it, John.
Okay, fine business, Dick. This is WA2 Victor David Henry. What I wanted to do was to comment on a statement I had made last week about power flow on a transmission line, and I wanted to use an example consisting of a generator, two wavelengths of line with a load. The generator I wanted to use is a 20-volt generator in series with 50 ohms. I wanted to use two wavelengths of line and then three different cases. So my case one is going to be a match. My case two is going to be a load of 50 plus J 100. And case three, I'm going to stick a capacitor in the middle. And it shows up very simply and beautifully how the power flow works on line. Let me drop. So what I wanted to do is to go through this case by case. I won't take too much time because I know time is of the essence, but it illustrates it very nice as far as the way power flows. To start with case one, my generator is 20 volts and in series with 50 ohms. So the maximum power I can get out of it when I put 50 ohms across it is going to be a voltage of 10 volts, and that's going to work out to be 10 squared over 50, which is 2 watts. When I hook that up to my matched transmission line, I get a forward voltage of 10 volts, and when it arrives at the load, it's 10 volts, and that gives me 2 watts. And that's the case of a match. I'm going to do case two in just a second. So in case two, my load is 50 plus J100. And this is the interesting one, because this was one that worked it out for me, in that we launch 10 volts, and the 10 volts, when it works its way down to the line, when it gets at the load, the reflection there is 0.707 at 45 degrees. This was the case that you had illustrated last week. And what happens is that the forward voltage is 10, the reflected voltage is works out to be 7.07. So if you work out the forward and reflected power, the forward power is 2 watts, and the reflected power works out to be 1 watt. So all we're getting to the load is 1 watt, and we're reflecting 1 watt. Let me drop. In case 3, what I'm going to do is stick a capacitor in the middle of minus J100. And this is the interesting one, because before the capacitor, the SWR is 1 to 1. But after the capacitor, we get a total voltage of about 22.36 volts. And when you resolve that into the forward and reflected voltage, you see that you get a forward power of 4 watts and a reflected power of 2 watts. So what's actually getting to the load is the full 2 watts. So, but after that capacitor, what's interesting is that the forward power is greater than the forward power you have in the part of the line where it's matched. So it illustrates, let me drop. It illustrates very interesting way how the power is re-reflected back to the load. After that matching capacitor, really was an eye opener to me a couple of years ago when I went through this. So it's a nice example to really go through and see how power flows on this line. Back to Ned.
Fantastic. Hey John, you're on a very interesting learning curve. guy smart enough to have a timer. You can tell by the beep here in the background. He knows when he's got to drop the machine to make sure he doesn't time it out. And starting off last week, I told you the easiest way to make a antenna impedance or load impedance, call it what you like, which gives you exactly half of all the power you apply to it being reflected. That exact number happens to be a 5.828 standing wave ratio. One of the easiest ways to create that exact standing wave ratio so that exactly half of your power gets reflected, let me drop, is to create mathematically an antenna that is a 50-ohm resistor in series with a 100-ohm reactor. And whether that 100-ohm reactor be an inductor or a capacitor doesn't matter. But that particular combination in series, and I haven't worked out the math yet, but there's a similar effect you get with a 50-ohm resistor and the right amount of reactants in parallel. There's an infinite number of ways of making that exact number of standing wave ratio, 5.828, where 50% of the power gets reflected. But that's the easiest one to mathematically handle, 50-ohm resistor in series with a 100-ohm reactor. Once you now have one-half of the power reflected from your antenna, it's hard to believe, but if you're smart enough, anywhere along the transmission line, you can do the impedance correction. Let me drop. As I often say, and I pick on the guys on 20 meters, you tell the guys on 20 meters that you can do that, and they'll say, no way in hell. You've got to make the impedance match right at the antenna. I will admit that, except for weather difficulties, making the impedance match to force the antenna to be a pure 50-ohm resistor by putting the right kind of a network right at the antenna does have a certain degree of simplicity and a certain degree of idealness to it. But if your transmission line is low enough in loss, you can make that impedance match an inch away, a foot away, 50 feet away, 200 feet away. You can do the impedance matching in the shack. And that's what John is telling you, that no matter where you put the impedance matching device, if you put the right kind of impedance matching device at that location along the transmission line, at least at that particular frequency, not only can you make a perfect impedance match, but of the half of the power reflected by the antenna, that impedance matching device will re-reflect the power forward towards the antenna, and you think you're doing impedance matching, and you are. Let me drop. But hidden to you, this is one of the cases where Mother Nature smiles on you. Murphy's Law doesn't quite strike you. When you do the proper impedance matching with your Pi network or whatever, your step tuner or whatever, you're doing an impedance matching, and simultaneously the power you're re-reflecting forward, the reflected power from the antenna, happens to work out to be in phase with the power now coming out of the transmitter. Mother Nature thinks in voltages. She adds the voltage being created by your transmitter at this time to the voltage that you re-reflected forward. They fall in phase, and the antenna eventually radiates all of that power if your transmission line is low enough in loss. Sounds too good to be true. You go on the 20-meter band, and I guarantee 80% of the people you talk to will say, yeah, a matchbox is a nice thing to use, but I don't like the fact that it's wasting power. They say things like that. They think that all the reflected power gets eaten up by the antenna tuner and thrown away. Well, you think about that hard enough and you realize that's a violation of conservation of energy. Once you've created RF power, there's only two things you can do with it. You either radiate it or you waste it as heat. There is essentially nothing else you can do with it. RF energy, once created, you can destroy it by turning it into heat. If your matchbox is well shielded and runs ice cold, it is not turning the power into heat. It has no mechanism of continuously absorbing and wasting RF energy. If the RF energy ain't stopping there, and it's not being wasted by your feed line, it's being radiated. Let me drop. So, if you want to understand the mathematics of this, if you understand so-called complex math, where you can deal with a real part and an imaginary part, usually represented by R plus JX, as they say, and if you can manipulate that with a Smith chart, with mathematics, with a computer program, or whatever, and you suddenly start understanding impedance matching, and we antenna engineers spend a tremendous percentage of our life impedance matching an antenna over a given frequency region, and we come headlong into this problem day after day after day. The number of people who know how to manipulate the mathematics, know how to manipulate a Smith chart, know how to manipulate a Pi network tuner, know how to manipulate a step tuning device, there's lots and lots of ways of doing it. The impedance matching device, if you put it in the right spot, can be a simple series reactor, a simple shunt reactor, or something else. But you're going to use lossless components in your matchbox. But impedance matching, so that all of the power of that particular antenna gets radiated, if you're smart enough, is almost easy. Learning the procedure will drive you up a wall at first. But it's an extremely good chunk of mathematics to learn. Let me drop. And once you learn that skill, once you have the ability to do that, you will probably double your job security if you're working for a organization that does RF engineering, antenna design, transmission line performance improvement, and so on. It's a rare skill, poorly taught by the schools, but they do a better job in this area. They do a better job of discussing impedance matching. They do an extremely poor job of discussing how to make, design, and understand antennas. They do a medium good job in our good electrical engineering schools of explaining the Smith chart and impedance matching techniques. I can tell that John's gotten into that. Looks like he's enjoying the process, and it's a magic skill to learn, John. And once your employer, as long as they're manufacturing the right products, understands the skill that you now have, they're going to think you walk on water. They're going to beat a path to your door. They're going to think about doubling your salary. Unfortunately, in these hard times, they're not going to do that. But don't you wish that somebody had explained this jazz to you earlier, John? WA2, Victor Delta Hotel. Sorry, I got your call wrong. K2RIW in the TechNet. Good luck on the timer of yours.
Just a word about the timer. The timer is the front of my old microwave oven from a few years ago when the magnetron crapped out. So I just kept the front panel, and what I do is just hit a minute plus so I can cook or talk for a minute. But it's really an eye opener. And what's very interesting is the way power flows after the matching component. But as far as job security, that's another story. Back to net control.
Yeah, John just said some magic words. Once you use an antenna tuner, and you also own a bird wattmeter, and you use it properly, at first you're going to make a set of measurements that are going to say, what in the world is going on here? Assume you've got a 100-watt transmitter. You've got the bird wattmeter between the transmitter and the matchbox. After the matchbox is your transmission line and your antenna. And assume that you had the worst-case situation that any of us is going to run into. This one that John analyzed, a 50-ohm antenna, which has an impedance that's in series with a 100-ohm reactor. That's that magic 5.828 standing wave ratio. That's the magic ratio where one half of all the power you apply to that antenna at first gets reflected backwards, back down the transmission line. And if you don't do something to tune that out, a 5.8 standing wave ratio with almost any transmitter we own today, the transmitter will simply say, forget it, John. I'm going to trip out. I'm going to go to a much lower power output, or I'm going to kill the transmitter entirely. You ain't on the air if you don't impedance match that. So you put in your matchbox, you properly adjust its controls with the bird wattmeter between the transmitter and the matchbox. You see 100 watts flowing forward, 0 watts flowing back, a 1-to-1 standing wave ratio. Everything's hunky-dory. Let me drop. Then if you're a good scientist and you put the bird wattmeter after the matchbox, all of a sudden, you're going to see a series of measurements that's going to say, what in the world is going on? You're going to see some amount of forward power, and you're going to see exactly half that amount of reverse power. That's the good news. You will see the 2-to-1 power ratio of forward and reverse. The antenna with that particular 5.8 standing wave ratio is creating that. And the antenna tuner keeps the transmitter happy. It corrects the standing wave ratio at the transmitter. It does not change the true standing wave ratio of your transmission line plus antenna. That reflective power is still going on. But now you decide to look at the forward power, and you say to yourself, my transmitter is making 100 watts, and if you're naive, you expect to see 100 watts flowing forward when the bird watt meter is after the matchbox. Uh-oh. You're going to see something much, much larger. I can recalculate that. I've been promising to do that. I'm not sure what the number is. Maybe you're going to see something like 160 watts forward and half of that flowing back. You're going to see a much, much bigger number. Because what Mother Nature does when you've got standing wave ratio and an impedance matching device is that she takes that reflected power and re-reflects it forward as a voltage. And the power coming out of the transmitter right now, your 100 watts, is a known amount of voltage. And what your matchbox is doing is adding those two voltages together in a co-phase vector manner and then sending it up the line. And then you, by the normal rule of I squared over R, E squared over R, you calculate that power. You're going to see what looks like a hell of a lot more power going forward. Really on the transmission, is that power flowing forward? Yes. You can put in a calibrated directional coupler. You can sample that power. You can light a light bulb with a fraction of that. It is real. It's not pure reactive power, as many people think. In my mind, it's real power flowing forward and real power flowing back because I can do something with it. I can prove that it's real, not just purely reactive. So you're going to see crazy numbers. The first time you see it, you're going to make the mistake of thinking your bird watt meter is lying to you. You're going to think your bird watt meter is only measuring voltage. That's not true. Let me drop. That bird watt meter and that slug really is a carefully calibrated directional coupler assembly. It is looking at the instantaneous voltage on that line at that point. It is simultaneously looking at the current that's flowing on that line at that point. It keeps track of the direction of the current that is flowing, and it puts those two numbers together correctly with reference to polarity and phase, and comes up with a true wattage reading for the power that is flowing in that direction on that point of that transmission line. And if your transmission line is low enough in loss, and if your bird watt meter slug is properly calibrated and has high directivity, you can put that bird watt meter an inch beyond the matchbox, a foot beyond the matchbox, 7.5 feet beyond the matchbox, or at the antenna. You will get the exact same numbers on that bird watt meter in all of those locations on that transmission line if the transmission line is low enough in loss. I will admit that if the transmission line has significant loss, as you move the bird watt meter down the line closer and closer to the antenna, both of those numbers will start going down to a slightly lower number because of the loss of the line. But they will keep that ratio per se. Not quite that ratio. Now, the ratio gets worse and worse as you get closer to the antenna and better as you get closer and closer to the shack. But you'll see those kinds of ratios. Ridiculously high apparent forward power, and you think you're generating more than 100 watts. You're not. But on that section of the line, more than 100 watts flowing forward will be there. It takes a... You start taking these particular measurements.
In regard, you're going to have a number of hot spots in the coaxial cable.
Thank you, Wesley. Another very good point. That standing wave ratio. In the old days, you used to measure the slotted line with ledger wires, whatever. As you move that probe along a slotted line, you will find individual places where the voltage is high and the current is low. And a quarter wave away, you're going to find another place where the current is high and the voltage is low. And this sequence keeps repeating over and over again. That's what the real standing wave ratio is. And depending on your particular brand of transmission line, and depending on what frequency you're using it at lower frequencies, the majority of the loss of the transmission line is resistive loss. So the places on the line where the current is the highest when you're running high power, you put your hand on the coax cable when you're running a key down condition, the coax cable will be higher in temperature at those spots. Those are the hot spots that Wesley is talking about. If you're at a UHF frequency where the loss tangent of the dielectric material of the coax cable starts becoming dominant, maybe the point where the places on the line where the voltage is highest is going to be the higher dissipation areas. They run hotter. But in either of those situations, most of the time, you slide your hand along a transmission line that has significant loss, you're running significant power, and you do it key down for, let's say, 5 minutes, you're going to find that line has a hot spot every half wave because of the standing wave ratio phenomena. And again, as I said, when you put your watt meter in those various places, you're going to see these crazy ratios. You bring those real measurement conditions that you do in your shack, you bring them to the guys on 20 meters and ask for an explanation and sit back and laugh and make a tape recording. You're going to hear theories like you wouldn't believe as to what's really going on. It's not real power, it's reactive power. The matchbox is really absorbing the power, it's not re-radiating it. It's increasing, the standing wave ratio on the cable is increasing the television interference. It's lowering the efficiency of the antenna system. They go on and on and on with all kinds of logical sounding theory. Unfortunately, some ridiculous percentage of that is strongly in error as far as real science is concerned. We here on the TechNet are trying to get to the bottom of all this and trying to educate the public as to what's really going on, because the number of people in the engineering, electrical engineering, wireless world who really understand this, unfortunately, is a small percentage. It's not easy, but if you're enough of a scientist and you want to know what's going on, it is worth the investment of the time to understand it. Looks to me like...
Repeater, timeout. Repeater, timeout. Cancel.
Looks to me like John has picked up that particular challenge, and well done, John. For the time being, you've done a very good job on your homework. You're going to get 100% on that particular homework submittal. Back to you, John, for any other comment. And what do you intend to do next? Fascinating. WA2, Victor, Delta Hotel, K2LIW in the TechNet.
Very good, Dick. Fine business. One thing I think that courses or analysis in transmission lines should begin with is a transient analysis, is just take a DC battery in series with a 50 ohm resistor or some other different resistors and watch how transients flow, how just DC pulses, how steps, closing of a switch, how the pulses propagate down the line, or watch what happens when you have a mismatch. I mean, in this case, it'll confine you to reflection coefficients that are real between plus and minus one, but it gives you a good idea about re-reflection and things like that. Rather than jump right into the RF case, I really think that you should begin with the transient case, and I think that would simplify the understanding of a lot of analysis. Back to Ned.
Comment.
Wesley recognized. I'm going to plug in some words first. You hit a very good point there, John. When you do a transient analysis, that's one of the very good ways of, in the electrical engineering world, understanding your circuit. If, for instance, you've got a battery, a resistor, and then a switch, and then the circuit you're analyzing. It may be a simple capacitor, or maybe an LC network, or whatever. And you close that switch and study what happens and understand it. An awful lot of good physics takes place. There is an instrument you and I can lay our hands on. It's a little bit rare on the flea markets, but it's called a time domain reflectometer. I've used those over the years, and if you understand what that thing can do, called a radar inside of a cable, if you like, it's a machine that repetitively puts out an extremely brief rise time signal called a pulse, and it looks at all the reflections. And it's a beautiful way of finding out what's going on in your transmission line, a properly used time domain reflectometer. If you want to really see what it can do, take, for instance, an oil tanker that's got a great big long transmission line going from the bow to the stern, and somewhere in the middle of that 500 feet of cable, a piece of load has shifted, it pinched the cable, and you're not getting a good signal. And you want to know where is the error. You apply a time domain reflectometer at one end of the cable. It says 421.5 feet down that line, there is an impedance perturbation, and the cable in that area has been pinched, and it's representing a 25-ohm transmission line instead of a 50-ohm line at that location. And you look at your schematic diagram for your ship, and you realize it's alongside of bulkhead number 42, and you go there, and you find the error. Beautiful piece of instrumentation. But let me give you some warning. did hear a beep, but I waited long enough. If you take a good time domain reflexometer, apply it to your transmission line, because you want to know how well is everything working, and you carefully tune your antenna itself, so the antenna is a pure 50 ohm load at your frequency of operation, and you got a 50 ohm transmission line, and you assume everything's going to be hunky-dory, and you look at that TDR display, you've got 100 feet of cable, and you've corrected for the velocity factor of the cable when you program your time domain reflectometer, and now you look at that system, and it tells you the transmission line is perfect, but there is something at the end of that transmission line that's almost a perfect short circuit. And you say, what in the hell is going on here? I got a 50 ohm transmission line. I've got an antenna carefully tuned to be 50.0 ohms with no reactance at my operating frequency. My standing wave ratio meter, my bird watt meter, tells me there is no reflected power. Everything's going forward. I connect the TDR, and the TDR tells me I've got a dead short at the far end where the antenna is located. What in the world is going on? Been there, done that. Let me drop. What we failed to realize is that the antenna itself, you've carefully tuned it at your favorite frequency. Maybe it's 50.1 megacycles, so to speak. Your TDR is putting out an extremely brief pulse in order to act like a radar so that you can easily resolve at what range is the error in the transmission system. That's where it really shines. It tells you not only the magnitude of the error, but how many feet downrange in that cable is the error. That's the good news. But in order to do that, it must issue an extremely brief pulse. You do a Fourier series on the extremely brief pulse, and you realize it's got a zillion frequencies to it. Maybe the pulses are coming out of there at one pulse per microsecond, a million pulses per second, and each individual pulse has a rise time of, let's say, 1 nanosecond or 1 picosecond, if it's a real good one. So the frequency domain for that thing is a whole bunch of comb lines, every 1 megacycle, starting off at 1 and going to 10,000. You've got 10,000 individual lines that will show up on your spectrum analyzer. That is the real frequency domain coming out of that time domain reflectometer. Your antenna is taking the one at 50 megacycles and beautifully absorbing that power. But your antenna was not tuned at all of those other lines coming out of that TDR in the frequency domain, and it's rejecting all of those. So 99.9% of all of those lines in this frequency domain are not being absorbed by your antenna, being reflected, and therefore you're going to see a TDR response at the antenna range that looks terrible. You have to know ahead of time how to interpret the display. It doesn't represent an error. It's a beautiful instrument. It's not perfect. Like everything else in life, you've got to properly interpret it. Wait for the beep. You've got you're ready for your comments, Wesley. N2XJN, K2LIW in the TechNet in New York.
November to X-ray, you read November. One and minus one gives you zero. If we stated one is your first statement and the minus one is your second statement, means you contradicting yourself. You stated that in a coaxial cable, when you put a bird watt meter, directional coupler, whenever you put that, you're going to have the same result. If you happen to get exactly to the point when you have a hot spot, you will not. And to Isaiah.
I've seen the effect you're describing, Wesley, and if I'm misusing the bird watt meter, first of all, some of the slugs have a better directivity adjustment. That's something that's done at the factory than others. Assuming that your bird watt meter is being checked by you at your favorite operating frequency, assuming you've got an extremely good, known, high-quality 50-ohm dummy load, and you put a reasonable power transmitter through that transmission line into that dummy load, you put in your bird watt meter, and the bird watt meter reads almost exactly the right amount of forward power, and then you flip the slug, and it reads almost the exact zero reverse power. That's a way of proving that the slug that you're using has high directivity. Under those conditions, if I'm using that slug within its power rating so that I'm not getting the nonlinear characteristics of its internal rectifying diode, then whether you put the bird watt meter at the hot spot, the cold spot, or whatever, it will read the exact same amount of forward power and reverse power if I'm not misusing that bird. However, I may be in a spot on the line where